For interviews on educational technology and for a list of our educational technology workshops, please visit www.edtechlive.com. And for discounted Dell computers, please visit our sponsor, www.k12computers.com.
Hi, this is Steve Hargadon, and it is Tuesday, April 17th, 2007. And welcome to EdTech Live. Today, my guest is Eric Langhorst, who is a junior high teacher, history teacher in Liberty, Missouri. How are you, Eric?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, no problem.
So, if you would, could you give a little bit of your background and maybe what brought you to your use of podcasting in the classroom?
Okay. Well, I'm an 8th grade American history teacher in Liberty, Missouri. It's a suburb just outside of Kansas City. And this is my 13th year in the classroom, my 6th year here in the Liberty School District. And I discovered podcasting, I'm trying to think now, 3 years ago, I believe. I began listening to David Warlick's podcast. I had seen Mr. Warlick at several conferences and then found on his webpage you could actually listen to him talking about some of the conferences he went to and some of the topics he was thinking about. And so I thought that was pretty interesting that I could listen to somebody that, you know, I can't obviously follow around the country or follow around the world, and I can bring him right into my my own basement. And then I started experimenting a little bit with buying an MP3 player, and I bought an MP3 player in the summer of 2005 and thought, hey, this is kind of cool. I'm going to try and record something. And I started a podcast called Speaking of History, which is mainly for teachers and people that like history, kind of an eclectic topic list. I'll talk about projects we're doing in class, or I'll talk about a museum that I went to or a book that I just read. So I started using that in 2005, and then gradually began to think of ways that I could use podcasting in the classroom. And that's when I came up with the StudyCast that I use with my students today.
So describe what that is. You call it a StudyCast.
Well, 2 years ago I started recording little audio reviews for upcoming tests. So I'd sit down and talk about some of the major points that my students needed to know for the test. And typically it takes about, you know, 15, 20 minutes or so. And I record that on my computer, and then I just put it as an MP3 file on my classroom site as a link. And then I also put it on a blog just to create the RSS feed so that iTunes will pick it up so that my students can also download it off of iTunes. And it's been really effective. I mean, the parents have made a lot of positive comments about it. We found that we have students that have reading disabilities, for example. They can listen to it multiple times if they want to. I have some students that will listen to it while they're doing chores at home or they're, you know, walking the dog, different things like that. And it's been a really positive experience for my students.
What percentage of your students do you think actually listen to the study casts?
Well, sometimes we'll actually listen to it in class, like the day before a test. So I know that, you know, when we do that, everybody gets to hear it. But typically, I'd say probably maybe 30 or 40% of my students listen to it at home.
Do most of them have MP3 players or iPods?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It kind of goes in ebbs and flows. Like last year, we saw a big increase after Christmas, and then we saw another big increase in the MP3 players after Christmas this year. I have always had the policy that if a student doesn't have internet access at home or an MP3 player, that I can burn the StudyCast to a CD for them and then give them the CD, and they can listen to it at home on a CD player. And I used to have about 5 or 6 students that would request those, and I'm currently down to none. So all my students are either listening to it on their MP3 players or they're listening to it on the internet connection at home. I did a survey last year at the end of the year, and I'm trying to remember the exact numbers of iPods. There are actually a lot more other brands of MP3 players than iPods, because now you can get an MP3 player for about, you know, $50 or $60, really. So we've seen quite a few more students have them. And our school is a little bit, I don't know if it's completely unique, but we have a pretty open policy as far as allowing MP3 players in our building. We have a policy that it's up to the individual teacher if they want to allow MP3 players or not in the classroom. And so, for example, we have quite a few teachers that will allow students when they're doing individual work to listen to their MP3 players through their iPods. So, for example, after they introduce a math concept, if they have time to work on their homework in class, they'll allow the student to listen to their MP3 player. And we found that some students, it's a great motivational tool, because if they're not on task, you can, you know, take that carrot away from them. It's also eliminated a lot of talking when people are working. If they want to listen to their MP3 player and they're still working, it doesn't really interfere with the person next to them. So I think for that reason, you know, a lot of students probably ask for an MP3 player also for Christmas because they know they could use it a little bit more in school.
So I'm definitely an auditory learner, you know, and I have a little creative MP3 player that actually plugs in directly to USB.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have some students for whom it's just not, it doesn't help them learn?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where I try to make it available as an option, but it's not something that's mandatory. So, you know, it's not to the point where I'm saying, hey, you have to go home and listen to this, you know, audio recording. I try to, with all the tools that we're using in the classroom, I try and make them be extensions of the classroom and optional things that can help. I don't have a one-on-one ratio in my classroom for computers, so I can't guarantee that every one of my students has internet at home or has a laptop. So things like the StudyCast or some of the projects we do that are kind of Web 2.0 based, I try and make those things that are like optional extensions. So if you are an auditory learner, you know, that'll help you out. But you know, if it's something that you don't want to use or, you know, you just don't feel comfortable with for some reason, you don't have to use it to succeed in my classroom.
Do you find that any of the parents are listening?
Yeah, I have quite a few parents at parent-teacher conferences that comment that, oh yeah, we love the StudyCast. We listen to it with the, you know, with my son or with my daughter. Some parents actually have said that it helps them, you know, sit down and help quiz their students on what they need to know. And I do give my students a paper copy, kind of we call it a study guide. So it has like some major concepts and terms or things like that that they need to know. And so that's kind of a physical thing that they can hold in their hand and then listen to the StudyCast as well. So you are kind of looking at something while you're listening to the review.
So I listened to your interview with Tom Wheeler on the Untold Story of Abraham Lincoln Using the Telegraph to Win the Civil War, which I really enjoyed, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
But that's certainly not a study cast. So
what
are you doing there?
Well, the Speaking of History podcast is really kind of, I guess I try and identify my audience as other history teachers, but I've had recently some junior high age students that have emailed me from different parts of the country saying, hey, I am homeschooled and my parents have found your podcast and we actually listen to it as part of our social studies instruction. Or I've had one mother in California that emailed me and said that she listens to it while she walks around and she just likes to hear the different topics we're talking about relating to history. So I think that's one of the cool things about having a podcast is you're really the one that can create what the content is. So for example, lately I've been doing a lot of interviews with authors of books that I've read. But then I can also do one on, you know, a project that we've done in class. So if you're someone that's mainly into history, you might be interested in the Tom Wheeler interview. And then the next day I might do one about a Civil War project we did. And that might not interest you, so you can click on your iPod and go on to the next one. So that's kind of, I like the freedom of having the podcast and being kind of the one that decides, hey, I'm going to do this today because it interests me, and the next day it might be completely different.
Do you have your students creating podcasts at all?
We've done a little bit. I've had my students use Audacity for various things. We did a project recently, for example, where we had to create a 30-second Abraham Lincoln ad for the 1860 election. And they did it using PhotoStory 3 and digital still images. But then they had to do a voiceover. And so they created some like background music. Then they did some speaking over that music. And so they created that in Audacity and then brought it into the PhotoStory 3 application. So, I mean, they've used Audacity a little bit. I haven't done a lot of podcasting where students are actually creating the podcast. Some of the things that I've done, I've actually recorded students and then just edited it myself to put it into a podcast. Last year we had some students that did a dramatic reading of a poem about the Underground Railroad, and they did it for a speech contest. And so we went ahead and recorded that in class and then put that up as a podcast, for example. So the students were actually reading and, you know, creating the content, but I was actually doing the editing on it. But that's something that we'd like to get into a little bit more. I just recently got my principals this year to do a podcast, and so I've got my two principals in the building recording, and then I kind of just polish it up a little bit in Audacity and then publish it on our school website as a principal podcast.
One of the themes that I've been kind of tracking is the sort of personal learning renaissance that takes place for educators and others who get involved in Web 2.0 without even thinking yet of the students. And I've noticed that teachers and administrators kind of get reinvigorated about learning when they become involved in the tools of Web 2.0. Have your experiences been the same?
Oh, definitely. I mean, with the whole aspect of blogging and podcasting, you know, my personal development as far as my content and just education theory in general has increased, because now I can have conversations with people that, you know, I probably would have never met, or maybe if I did meet at a conference, I might have met for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. I mean, I'm constantly having discussions with other people that have either very, very similar interests to mine or are asking the same questions that I am. So I found the whole Web 2.0, you know, concept to be extremely, extremely, I guess you said, invigorating, and I guess I'd agree with that. I know, like, Will Richardson talks about, you know, he learned more in blogging over the last couple of years than he learned in all of his formal education, and I mean, I would totally agree with that. And I talked to Tom Wheeler about a book that he wrote last weekend in my basement and recorded it, and, you know, you listened to it. I mean, when am I going to have the opportunity to sit down one-on-one with the author of a book like that? And then as kind of an added bonus, I got to share it with other people, and I put it up last week, and I looked the other day, and I think it's been downloaded like 500 times. So, I mean, that's an incredible experience to share with people.
So a sort of a secondary theme that comes out of that is that as teachers are getting kind of reinvigorated, that it's opening the door to talking about pedagogy. And there's, at least in from the educational bloggers, there seems to be kind of a desire to figure out how to get students that engaged as well. Has your experience with podcasting and other Web 2.0 tools informed you in any way with regard to thinking about how schooling might change in the next 10 years?
Well, I mean, I think one of the big changes that will eventually happen is that every student has their own laptop, you know, whether that comes in the form of state-funded programs or, you know, something similar to the one-on-one laptop project that comes to the United States. I think that eventually that will be a big turning point when students are definitely assured of having that ability to connect to the Internet and produce things on their own. You know, I kind of, as I talked about before, the things that I do now that are Web 2.0, I try to kind of tend to do as an extra instead of something that's really mandatory. And I think once we get to that point where every kid has a computer, we can do a lot more things as far as having them produce things and kind of getting out of that mold. So you know, I think Web 2.0 will definitely have an impact. I don't know exactly what the tipping point's going to be. I don't think we're obviously there yet. And I don't know what event's going to bring that about. You know, but I think sometime in the next 3 or 4 years, there's going to be some event that really changes the way that we educate our students. At least I hope that happens soon.
What's your favorite podcast that you've done?
Wow, favorite podcast I've done. I did one last year. It was actually on the anniversary of when I started the podcast. I was out in San Diego and was attending the NET conference. And before we left, we had kind of a little bit of spare time, so I went on the USS Midway that's docked there and did a podcast from the USS Midway and interviewed a couple of the people that were the tour guides and stuff. And so I thought that was pretty incredible to do a podcast from the deck of such a historic ship like that. You know, but some of the interviews that I've done have been really interesting, too. The Tom Wheeler one was obviously really interesting. I did one with some of the people that did some of the directing in some History Channel productions of the 10 Days That Unexpectedly Changed America. And that was kind of interesting to get their perspective from a producer's point of view on creating something that's going to be used in the classroom for years to come. So those would be kind of some of the ones that stick out, I guess.
What podcasts that aren't your own do you listen to?
Well, I listen to The Speed of Creativity by Wesley Fryer. I listen to KidCast. That's one by Dan Schmidt. I actually know Dan Schmidt from doing some education things in Nebraska. I'm actually a native of Nebraska, so I listen to his. I think some of the other ones I listen to a lot. I listen to a bunch of different ones, and sometimes I'll listen to maybe two or three of them and then listen to another one. Ed Tech Talk, I try and listen to some of those from the guys up in Canada. Man, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of all the ones that I've got on my RSS feed. The Colonial Williamsburg podcast, they've done a really high-quality job for about 2 years now on their podcast, and that's always very interesting. I really try and sample a lot of different ones and just kind of see, you know, what kind of trips my trigger for a couple days or a couple weeks. The TED Talks ones, both the video, if you download those, and then also the audio from the TED conferences, those are really good because, again, those are a lot of different topics and very interesting people, very unique, creative people.
Are there other Web 2.0 tools that you're a particular fan of?
Yes, I teach a grad class on using technology in the classroom, and actually this next week we're doing a Google Week, and so we're talking about some of the applications that Google has. And one of the things I'm going to try and do a lot of this summer is play around with Google Earth and try and do some different things with that and incorporate that, obviously, in my history class. But I've also seen some really creative applications where you can use it with literature class if you're trying to map out where events happened in a story. For example, I saw one really good example of on the Grapes of Wrath where you can actually create one of the tours. You can actually put in video at different places and talk about some of the places that are mentioned in the book. So I want to really get into Google Earth some more. I think that a great application that I don't hear a lot of people talking about, and I don't specifically use a lot right now, but I'd like to, is Google Documents, where students can do collaborative work online, and you don't have to worry about bringing your flash drive home and saving stuff to an external file or anything. You can do all your work online, and you can have people come in and edit it and share it. I think that has a lot of potential as well. So those are two things I'm going to try and experiment a little bit more over the summertime.
I have to say I'm a particular fan of Google Docs. Yeah. I've used it with my own daughter, who is in a History Day competition. Hmm. And she, at least here in California, so she made it to the California State Finals for 8th grade this year. And she had to finish the project when she was out of town.
Wow.
And she and I were apart. And so we used the Google Doc while we were on the phone together to map out everything that needed to be done. And then I could put notes in there, and then she could check off when she had finished each thing that needed to be accomplished. And it was so nice not to have to be emailing back and forth, but just to have one place to keep track of all of that.
There's an instructor at UNLV, Christy Keeler, and we co-authored an article that we have submitted for publication about using technology in the social studies classroom. And so she's out in Las Vegas, and I'm here in Missouri, and we actually worked together over the course of 3 or 4 days. And she wrote part of the article, and then I'd edit it a little bit, and then I'd add a paragraph, and she'd edit it. And it's just incredible. You can go on and see what's recently been edited, and you can make comments to each other. You can ask other people to view it. I mean, there's so many options there.
So one of the things that I've wondered might happen for an educator would be that they might feel a little awkward about kind of putting themselves out there, whether it's a blog or a podcast, because I'm not an educator, but I'm imagining that if you spend years and years in a calling or a job that requires that you be critical of other people's work, do you feel pressure that you're going to make a mistake or someone's going to think less of you because you haven't been as eloquent as you might want to be?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought of that. I mean, you know, for example, if I had, I don't record all my lectures in class or anything, but if I did, that'd be something that I would be concerned about because, you know, what if I missaid something and then, you know, possibly 2% of my lecture is seen as being incorrect and then it might taint everything else that I said. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I think that you are kind of putting yourself out there, but I think that also, just like when a student is going to put something on a blog or they're going to turn something in that's going to be seen by multiple eyes, they're going to be more conscientious about what they put down, and I have to be more conscientious about what I put out there on the Internet. So, you know, I try and be as accurate as possible. Obviously, I'm sure that there's probably mistakes in a podcast here and there where I talk about something that's incorrect, but I think that any time that you put something on the web, you're going to have that. And it's not just a web environment. I mean, just in what people write, whether it be a paper or an article or whatever, you know, obviously it's multiplied when it gets out there on the web, but I think you're going to have those errors, you know, no matter what you do. I'd much rather have that conversation and possibly have somebody say, hey, you know, maybe you could, you know, add this, or maybe you need to research this a little bit more, than not have the conversation in the first place.
Have you found that there's been a better way or a particularly good way to help educators get into the world of Web 2.0?
I think one of the biggest things is just having the time available to play with these tools. I mean, if you come in and do a 20-minute workshop on using Audacity to create a podcast and then just leave it at that and, you know, go on your way, unless people can really dig in and start using it themselves, they're never going to get to that step where they want to invest the time to actually do it for the first time for a class or, you know, do it for a lecture. So I think the main thing is just giving people the time. The graduate class that I mentioned earlier, we have it's a night class, so it meets from like 5 to 9:30. And so we have the time to actually introduce different applications and then kind of give people the time to play with them and ask questions. And that's really been beneficial because I think so much of what we do with computers is, hey, here's a 20-minute in-service, and then see ya, you know, go work on it on your own or find time at home to work on it. And that model just doesn't work.
Let's make sure people know what your websites are.
Okay. My podcast is Speaking of History, and that's at www.speakingofhistory.blogspot.com. And if you want to come to my classroom webpage, probably the easiest thing to do is go to the Speaking of History site that I just mentioned, and on the blog roll on the right-hand side, one of the top links says, I think it's Mr. L's classroom or Mr.
Langhurst's virtual classroom.
Yes, yeah, just click on that, and that'll take you to our classroom page. And we're kind of undergoing a change in that because our district is moving to Blackboard, and so I'm going to keep that site up, but it's going to kind of gradually migrate a lot of the content over to a Blackboard site this spring and later this summer. But I'll still have that web presence and have some stuff up for people at the website.
If there was one piece of advice you'd give educators who are thinking about Web 2.0, what would it be?
Don't be afraid to jump in and play with it. I think that people get really intimidated by a blog or a podcast, and I think we're getting into the realm where people at least know what those terms are, so they're not automatically scared of them. But, you know, jump in and just start small and just start using them and ask your students how you can help them be better students. I'm constantly trying to ask my students, hey, what's the best way for me to put content up so that you can get it? You know, does it help if I put it up as a PDF file on our website? Or, you know, would it be easier if I just mailed you a copy of the notes that we just did, and, you know, things like that. And ask your students how they access information normally and then implement those tools.
Eric, it sounds like you're doing a great job.
Well, I try. I mean, I try to make it interesting, and history is a great subject to teach, and I'm just trying to kind of put a technology twist on it. So,
thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.